Good morning, Woof. Good morning. It's great to see everybody this morning. Welcome. I love all the lively conversation and energy that you've brought into our beautiful space this morning. Welcome. We are so glad that you are here. My name is Scott Winters, and my pronouns are he and him, and it's very good to be your lay leader here at West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. It's always a joy for me to be with this loving and generous and vibrant community. Whether you are watching online now, or watching this as a recording, or here in person, we recognize your hope and desire to come into community. You've come to a good place, a place where you can be who you are. If this is your first time here, we especially want to welcome you. Thank you for being here. We encourage you to fill out one of our welcome forms or to scan the little card in the seat in front of you, and that will provide you with some information about the service and also for upcoming events that we do here at WOOF. We're a very active community, and it's really kind of fun to see what's happening. As Unitarian Universalists, we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of everyone. No matter who you love, your gender, or how you express it. We welcome your race, your ethnic background, your heritage, your immigration status. You are welcome here. For the benefit of those with visual impairment, I'm a white, middle-aged man with glasses wearing a blue shirt today. Our Sunday services are both offered in person and online, and today's service is being live streamed. In our efforts to help care for all of our online folks that are watching right now, we ask that everybody here please put your phones into airplane mode or just simply turn them off so that we can keep a nice sacred silence during the service. For our online viewers, we offer a follow-up coffee hour that is directly after the service. And there's a link in the order of service that came with the email that came this morning. We also have an in-person coffee hour downstairs following the service for all of our folks here. And it's a great time to share in conversation and to talk about the service today. And today is also group soup, I believe. Yes, so awesome. And do we have any announcements about the auction last night? I wasn't able to attend myself, but I heard it was really fun, and I see that there's still glitter on the floor. So hope it was a great time. I look forward to hearing about it. All right. So nice to hear all the lively conversation this morning. I have some exciting news to share. I did receive just an update on how we are doing with the auction, and so far we've raised $13,603. So that is really amazing. And for our, yes, Howard. Wonderful. That's great. And for our special project of providing electricity for our shed, we have $6,675 towards our goal of $11,000. And so we're still accepting donations and all of the gifts that you want to provide for that. So it's an exciting time of year here at WOOF, and it's a time for us all to come together, to work together for our beloved community. Our guest speakers today are Randy and Edith Woodley. They are a dynamic couple whose lives have been shaped by their deep passion for creativity and their unwavering commitment to Indigenous spirituality, justice, and empowerment. Dr. Randy Woodley, a legally recognized Kitoa Cherokee descendant, is an accomplished author, theologian, and teacher. His creative spirit is evident in his thought-provoking writings that explore the intersection of Indigenous wisdom, ecological sustainability, theology, and spirituality. Edith Woodley, a member of the Eastern Band of Shoshone Indians and of Choctaw, Crow, Paiute, Flathead, Blackfoot, and Mohawk descendant, As an accomplished beadworker, seed keeper, and storyteller, Edith's work captures the beauty and resilience of indigenous cultures, highlighting the vibrant stories and traditions that often go unnoticed. Together, Randy and Edith have founded and co-sustain Eluhe Indigenous Center for Earth Justice, an Eluhe Farm and Seeds, a nonprofit organization that seeks to foster equity and justice between indigenous peoples and the wider society. Please help me welcome Randy and Edith today. And now I'd like to invite Avery to please come forward as we light our chalice. We begin our time in community by lighting the symbol of Unitarian Universalists all over the world. The chalice cup with the flame is our symbol. Spark of the spirit, cupped in earth's embrace. Light of love, alive in all creation. As we kindle this flame, we rekindle our connection to the sacred web of life. I invite you to join me as we share in these words of affirmation together. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful and what is wondrous. Let us open our minds to learn what is true and what is mysterious. Let us open our hearts to love one another and our neighbors. Our opening reading today is Earth Prayer by Sharon Dittmar. Mother Earth, we are gathered here this morning to bask in your beauty and reflect on your place in our lives. Too often we forget how you feed us, whisper in our ears, and sprinkle our sleep with dreams. Help us to remember that through you we are all joyfully connected. We pray for your presence among us, Great Mother. Our burdens can be great, and we feel alone. Our hands have not felt the touch of another, and our hearts long for reconciliation, compassion, and understanding. Now, on this day, we open our hearts to you and to one another. We breathe in your love, and we feel that we are worthy of love. We feel your touch and know that we are touched. We pray for the well-being of all creatures of the earth, for your spirit, Mother Earth, lives within and connects us all. Thank you for the many gifts and blessings in our lives. As we give love, may we also receive love. Amen. Please rise as you are willing and able, and we're going to sing our opening hymn, The Tide is Rising.
On screen? Oh.
The tide is rising, and so are we. The tide is rising, and so are we. The tide is rising, and so are we. This is where we're meant to be. This is where we're meant. The task is mighty, and so are we. The task is mighty, and so are we. The task is mighty, and so are we. This is where we're meant to be. This is where we're meant. The sun, the land is holy, and so are we. The land is holy, and so are we. The land is holy. is raging, and so I weep. The storm is raging, and so are we. The storm is raging, and so are we. This is where we're meant to be. This is where we're meant to be. The sun is shining, and so are we. The sun is shining, and so are we. This is where we're meant to be. This is where we're meant to be. The world is ready, and so are we. Is ready, and so are we. This is where we're meant to be. This is where we're meant to be. The tide is rising, and so are we. Is rising, and so are we. This is where we're meant to be. This is where we're meant to be.
Children are now invited and welcome to come forward and sit in the front row if you'd like to. And Edith is going to share with us a wonderful story today.
Life in the great forest was happy. The ancient trees protected the younger ones from growing too fast and provided plenty of food and shelter for many, many creatures. Everyone, from the ruffed grouse, the black bear, to the white-tailed deer and the milk snake, lived in balance and harmony. See them? But one day, without warning, everything changed. The trees heard a frightful, terrible noise. It was a noise unlike any had ever heard before. It was loud. It was rough. It buzzed like 1,000 wounded bumblebees. And then the noise did the unimaginable. One after the other, trees fell to the ground. First, it was the smaller trees. Their cries echoed throughout the forest. But the ancient trees could not stop this horrible sound. Soon after the old trees were cut down too, falling quietly from the clouds, and then crashing to the ground. The ancient ones fell and fell and fell until there was only one tree left standing. She was an ancient grandmother, oak, and she did not know why she had been spared. See all those oak trees? Except for the one. It had been cut down. Grandmother Oak waited for that terrible sound to come again. Day after day she wondered when she would fall. Years went by, and Grandmother Oak's only comfort was remembering the years she shared with her friends and relatives in the ancient forest. All alone, Grandmother Oak longed for the oak to be filled again with the young oak saplings. Each autumn, she would drop acorns from her branches. But the seeds turned to young trees. Guess what? The terrible noise returned. And the trees once again fell. After many years of trying, Grandmother Oak's acorns stopped falling to the ground. She felt like she was dying, no longer able to encourage new growth. See, her acorns, the new growth, and then they cut them all down again. Many years passed before Grandmother Oak saw another tree. Then one day, square houses started appearing, each surrounded by a fence. And strangely, to her surprise, trees suddenly appeared in front of each house. There was something odd and unfamiliar about the new trees. They certainly were vibrant and beautiful, but they looked very different. They did not grow from seeds, as far as Grandmother Oak could tell. When they appeared, they were all well on their way to adulthood. Even though the new trees were so unusual, Grandmother Oak was so thrilled to be able to talk to another tree. "Welcome to your new home," she exclaimed. All them in front of the houses. "New home?" one of the trees replied. "This ain't our new home. We've been here for a long time." "Yes, this land has always been our home," said another tree. The new trees talked to each other about the old grandmother tree and how strange she seemed, hurt by their words. Grandmother Oak became silent. The new trees grew fast. It was astonishing how quickly they shot up, but it was too fast. When storms came, they couldn't stand with the wind, and their branches often broke. Sometimes the young trees blew completely over because their roots were so shallow. When a tree was damaged, the other trees would wait anxiously. They had heard stories about what happened to injured trees, that they were always replaced with new ones. There is no time for the trees to heal. When clouds gathered and skies darkened, the new trees cried and wondered who would be next to break. After years of silently watching, Grandmother Oak decided to speak. "Friends, you need deeper roots to be strong." "Deeper roots?" they asked. One of the young trees, "How do we get deeper roots?" Grandmother Oak answered, "Tell me the stories that connect you to this land." The young trees thought to themselves. They were startled. How many stories from faraway places? Some had stories that spoke of old and new lands, but none had stories that went far, far into this ground. None of them had stories of how this land came to be. Stories that told the power of this place. Stories of how the Creator was behind and inside it all. Eventually, a few of the trees became curious about the old oak tree. "Grandmother Oak, do you know the stories of this land? Can you tell us what makes your roots so strong?" Grandmother Oak smiled and began to speak about the ancient forest she knew so well. She started with the recent past and those dark days when her friends and family fell to the terrible noise. The cries of those trees were still a faint echo. And now that the new trees were listening, they too could hear them. Grandmother Oak spoke of the happy days when her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren surrounded her, all the way back to the 12-tree generation. She shared about the old trees that spent their mornings listening to the songbirds that landed on their branches. flocks of passenger pigeons stopped on their migration and roosted for the night. Herds of wildland buffalo and elk took turns grazing on the grasses that grew between them. Grandmother Oak recalled how the ivory-billed woodpecker dug for insects on her branches, and how the golden eagles sat on her highest limbs at dusk, watching for their supper. The young trees leaned in to listen and could almost feel their roots slowly reaching down to find new streams of water. They stretched a little taller as they heard tales of the ancient forest. Grandmother Oak's stories seemed as if they could go on forever, and they would have without interruption. But something happened. All the trees heard the faint sound together. A soft thump had hit the ground. What do you think it was? "What was that?" asked the young trees. "Don't worry, friend," said a joy-filled Grandmother Oak. "One of my acorns just dropped to the earth." They all smiled together as they thought about the seeds of the new growth. Grandmother Oak's branches stretched out, tickling the clouds. She could feel a gurgle of sap bubbling up inside her, reaching all the way from her strong roots to the tips of her tiny twigs. Cool nights and her changing colorful leaves told her that autumn was on the way. A time to rest, stand tall, and hope for the future of the whole forest once again. So this was a story about what? Trees. Why do you think this story is important?
Because it's about nature and they want the nature to stay healthy.
That's right. That's right.
It's important because if people are always cutting down trees and none of the trees will become old.
That's right. They do. They fill each other with. That's why they grow so deep roots, so they can talk to each other. They can feel each other and help each other. And you know what? All those animals that Randy talked about, they're not here anymore. Some of these animals aren't anywhere. Like the, where is it? Like the woodpecker. The ivory-billed woodpecker. There's no more ivory-billed woodpeckers because they've gone extinct. And the woodland buffalo. They're not anymore. They're gone also. And these passenger pigeons, they're gone too. And a lot of these different birds, they're gone. Because when we cut down lots of trees, we get rid of all those animals too, because they have no place to live. That's why trees are so important.
Thank you so much, Edith. So I invite you to take a deep breath. A deep cleansing breath. To feel your lungs expanding, your heart beating, your body resting and responding. And I invite you to reflect on our deep connection and our relationship with all of life on earth. And we call to mind with gratitude for the fresh air, the abundant life of the forest all around us here, and for the clean water that we have the privilege of drinking. Consider how you are a steward of this earth. There are many ways that we can make a tangible difference. Being a green sanctuary is one of the ways that WWF works towards a vision of a healthier, more sustainable future. As a recognized green sanctuary, we live with a deep awareness of our climate crisis and the deep environmental injustices of our time. And we are committed to sustainability, education, and partnering with marginalized communities who are hit first and hardest by the environmental crisis. I'm grateful to be a part of this religious community that is devoted to growing deeper in both our understanding and in our action for environmental justice. As we receive the offering this morning, consider the gifts that you have to offer, whether it be through your financial contributions or the sharing of your energy, your time, and your creative ideas as well. Your generosity makes a difference for everyone on this journey of connection, sustainability, and hope. The offering will now be gratefully received. Thank you so very much for your generosity. And please join me now in our affirmation of gratitude and giving. Let us be grateful when we are able to give, for many do not have that privilege. Let us be grateful for all those who share their gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful even for our needs, so that we may learn from the generosity of others. There is much that we bring here for our time together this morning, much that is on our hearts. Whether you're experiencing joy, abundance, and happiness, or if you're grieving, if you're in pain, if your heart is hurting today, we invite you to participate in our water ritual, to recognize and honor all that is our life. As Betsy plays for us, you're invited to come forward as you feel moved and place a stone into the bowl of water. The water represents us, our community, that shares our joys and compassionately bears our sorrows. And together, we create a circle of love that is deep enough and wide enough to hold all that is on your heart today. For those online, you are invited to speak aloud your joys and your sorrows. Perhaps you're alone, perhaps you're with others, or you can type them into the online chat. Here, I'll have a microphone for folks that would like to share a couple of words about your joys, your gratitudes, or your sorrow. And please keep in mind that your sharing is part of our live recording, which will be posted later online.
I'm grateful for the generosity of this congregation.
As we enter into a time of reflection, we continue to hold the people in the Middle East in our compassion, love, and care. Let us now take a minute of silence to pray, to meditate, and to reflect, as is your tradition or practice. Randy will now offer us a song.
So, if you'd like to stand. Traditionally, we face the four directions when we do this. You're welcome to do that or not do that. It's up to you. We always start off in the east. We sing our songs four times for that reason, to basically pray and bless the whole world. The words of this song translate to, Great Spirit, when you see me, see that I'm a part of everything and I'm just a human being. Uare kura se aheya, uare kura se aheya, aheya, uare kura se aheya, uare kura se aheya. Da se aheya, aheya, uare kura se aheya, uare kura se aheya. If you want to turn to the south. Oare kura se aheya. Oare kura se aheya. Oare kura se aheya. Oare kura se aheya. Da se aheya.
To take another deep cleansing breath and feel that grounding into the earth. This is a reading by Vaclav Havel. We must divest ourselves of our egotistical anthropomorphicism, our habit of seeing ourselves as masters of the universe, who can do whatever occurs to us. We must discover a new respect, what transcends us, for the universe, for the earth, for nature, for life, and for reality. Our respect for other people, for other nations, and for other cultures can only grow from a humble respect for the cosmic order, and from an awareness that we are a part of it, that we share in it, and that nothing of what we do is lost, but rather becomes part of the eternal memory of being, where it is judged.
So my wife and I are co-sustainers at Alahe Indigenous Center for Earth Justice and the Alahe Farm and Seeds, so we're just farmers. And then we keep seeds. About 95% of our seeds are heirloom. Probably about 30% are native seeds from different tribes around. And so we think it's really important to continue to keep those things and to make sure that they're here. We've lost 70% of our seeds that we have available since 1900, believe it or not. So that's a lot of loss. The story today is sort of a little bit about loss. If you heard the harmony tree, Edith asked the children what it meant, but I wonder if the adults got the deeper meaning. So I wrote the book to number one, animate nature for children, so they would stop seeing nature as objects, right? But as something alive and part of us. And secondly, to basically preach against clear cutting. So that was the direct message. But then there was a little deeper message, right? And it was about how host people and settler people can get along. And so if you really got the message of the children's story, you can leave now. You've got the whole sermon. It's all there. I wanted to tell a couple stories and then talk a little bit about the mess that we're in. The first story I want to tell, I was back in 1984 to 86, I was what I refer to my years as a missionary oppressor in Alaska. And those were my missionary oppressor years. And I was working with Native children, Native youth, and very much going against everything cultural, and I knew that I was. And so I had to sort of like almost live a double life for me to have any kind of sanity whatsoever. So I had to sort of like act one way with the kids and then give different reports when I filled out all the things. So it was very oppressive to them, and sort of left Alaska saying, I never want to oppress my people again. So I went on a long journey to make sure that I didn't ever do that again. But while I was up there living on Kodiak Island, I heard a story, and that's the story I want to start off sharing with you. And the story's about a little boy who lived with his grandmother, which is not unusual. We have a lot of loss in our communities. For example, when I was a pastor in Carson City, Nevada for 7 years, I did 66 Native funerals. So, because you pastor the whole community when you're a Native pastor. And I thought that was some kind of a sad record until 2 weeks ago, and I met one of Edith's relatives who pastors on her reservation, and she's been there 7 years also. That's on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. And she said she had done 300 funerals in the 7 years. So you can see how that story of the Harmony Tree really is about colonization, and you can see how colonization has affected our people. So anyway, the little boy's living with his grandmother, and they run out of all the good stuff for the winter, and so for the rest of the winter, all they have left to eat is dried seal and seal oil, which is pretty common up there. Anybody had dried seal? Or muktuk? You ever had muktuk? Yeah, so the little boy, you know, the grandson, day after day eating the same thing, waiting for spring, and he got tired of it. And so he asked his grandmother, he was not quite old enough to hunt, but he asked his grandmother if he could just go down to the stream and get a needlefish. And just needlefish are a little small, and maybe get a few of those and eat. And so finally, after begging, the grandmother said, sure, yeah, go ahead and but don't go any farther than the stream. Well, he saw the needlefish, and he got one, and he thought, well, you know, if I take that back to grandmother, there's not even enough for me here, so I'm just going to eat it now. And so he did. And then he started thinking, maybe I should just go a little farther and find something else. And so he goes down to where the stream meets the river, and he finds a salmon. And the salmon wasn't that big, but, you know, it's tasty. But he thought, let me go ahead and just eat this salmon, and then maybe I'll go find something bigger. Well, you can imagine how the story goes, right? So he goes down, and then you know, he ends up finding a bigger fish than a salmon. He finds a halibut. He eats the halibut. He goes out farther. Eventually, he finds a walrus, and he eats the walrus. And he continues to follow all the way down to the point where he finally finds a whale. And he eats the whale, and each time the boy's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, right? And so he finishes the whale, and he's thirsty, and so he goes out and he finds a small lake, and so he drinks the whole lake down in order to quench his thirst. And by the time he's done, the boy is somewhat of a monster, and he's giant, and he's sloshing back and forth, and he's crying, and he's like, you know, how do I ever find my way back home to my grandmother? I wouldn't even fit in the house. And so he starts to make his way home. And as he does, he gets sadder and sadder. And finally, he stands outside the home and realizes it's not his home anymore because he can't go inside and see his grandmother. And his grandmother hears him outside crying. And the grandmother says, son, I want you to come through the chimney. Grandson, come through the chimney.
and everything will be okay. And he's like, no, Grandma, I'll never fit through the chimney. And so he keeps, it's a simple, very simple request. And so finally he goes down the chimney and he comes back down and he's the grandson again. And he'd learned his lesson. And that's the story of Western civilization. That's the story of Western settler folks and host people. In the last 66 million years, we've never had as much carbon as we've put out just in the last 20 years. We've had the last 4 months before fall hit us were the world's hottest months on record. And we continue to go searching for more and more and more. And so what I would like to present to you today is I'd like to convert you. I'm here to convert you. I'm here to convert you, and we're all affected by it, by a Western worldview. I'm here to convert you from a Western worldview to a more indigenous worldview. Because a Western worldview will not sustain us in the future. It will not sustain these children down here if we don't change. It's not about thinking. It's about doing. Now, why do I say that? Well, let's think about how we got in this mess. At the time of quote-unquote discovery, we all know when that was, right? That's 1490, what was it? Two, yeah. 1492. Some fellow was lost and the indigenous people found him. And so what happens? What's going on in Europe at the time? Why is Europe in such a mess trying to go and colonize other peoples? Well, that's what happens when you misuse your own land. You use up all your resources and then you have to go out and look for other peoples and then enslave them so that they can get those to you cheap. Does that sound like something from the past, or does that sound like something that's still going on here? And so that's the process of empire and colonization. So what was going on in Europe at the time? I found out something really interesting when I was doing research. I was a professor for 15 years. I just retired in December as professor emeritus. And one of the research projects I did was find out what the first exports from America were. Do you know what they were? No, that's what everybody thinks that, right? Because of this, that's the myth. Oak trees. Virgin oak trees. The reason why is because Europe had cut most of their hardwood forests down. You have to have oak and other hardwoods in order to smelt iron. And what do they need iron for? War. Right, to make weapons, tools, to build things. They need castles. They need cathedrals built. They need all of these things. And so the first things that went from this country over to England were these virgin oak trees that they cut down and start shipping back. And so you have a lot of your buildings over there that are, 500 years, around 500 years old, actually made from American oak. And just the small forests that they had, those were owned by the kings and by the gentry. So, and people couldn't hunt them. And so what was going on in England at the time? They had cut down most of their oak forests. Many of their large mammals were going extinct. Pollution reigned the land. They would, dump, their sewage and everything outside their homes. It was the bays and the rivers were pretty much fished out and polluted. Like beer was the most common drink because you couldn't drink the water anymore. There was classism, terrible classism, like the one percenters owned everything, right? And the only way to get ahead in your class was if you were to marry up, because you had almost, or do some great deed that got recognition, but there's very little chance. And so I understand why those people wanted to come here. The only thing standing between them and what would be considered material wealth were Native Americans. And so all of this is going on. Disease, rampant disease, all of these things are happening. because of the way they misused their land. Now, if any of that sounds familiar, a lot of that is the same things that are plaguing us today. And the only thing that hasn't changed is the Western worldview, which is about extraction. It's about not seeing ourselves as part of everything, not seeing the whole community of creation as our relatives, but seeing us as being over everything else. Seeing us as, even the word stewardship sort of implies that we're in charge. I have news for you. Mother Nature is in charge. And what's happening now, and this is kind of weird for people to think about, but what's happening now is Mother Nature is saying, if you are going to consume so much, I'm going to stop you. And that's what we call climate change, and that's what we call these natural disasters. So it turns out that in terms of energy, there's one species actually that gets all the energy comes from the sun, and one species besides the trees that absorbs most of the energy on Earth. Do you know what that species is? Shout it out. Nope. So it's probably right on the tip of your tongue. Phytoplankton. Right? Yeah, and phytoplankton are out there in the ocean, and they're just absorbing all the energy. And guess who feeds on phytoplankton? Plankton. So they're the largest consumer of energy on Earth is plankton. They're consuming all this, you know, phytoplankton and taking up the Earth's energy. And then there are some fish that sort of come in close, but humans are way down the line. We're what they call tertiary consumers. If you ever heard of, anybody ever have goats? We've owned goats lots of times. Goats like to just go take a bite here and then take a bite there, and they'll see something they like over here. That's a tertiary consumer. They're just, but humans, since the modern age, have come from being tertiary consumers to primary consumers. We're taking all the water. We're taking all the minerals. We're taking all the oil. Whatever it is down there, corporations and their boards and their stockholders are saying, we deserve this. They don't look at the earth as being alive. They look at it as something to be consumed. And so the earth has put up with this for a long time, but finally it's striking back. So in a sense, you know, because nature's number one rule is adaptability. Like that's why nature still exists, because Mother Nature adapts. She learns, you know, how to adapt to different environments, different situations. But people don't adapt very well. We're kind of like, we like what we call homeostasis, right? We like things to be the same. We like things that, you know, give us security or make us feel secure. But actually, the way that the West has done this is not security, it's insecurity. It's not order, it's chaos. So what we think when we build in a homeostatic way, we think that that is order, but that's actually chaos because it's not adaptable. We have to learn from nature. If we want to exist in the future, we have to learn to have adaptable organizations, to be adaptable people, to create adaptable buildings, etc. And we're having to learn to adapt, but we don't know if we can adapt fast enough with climate change. The future's still hanging out there. And we'll see. So all of this is going on, you know, as we go about our daily lives. I remember the last time I felt a sense of doom in the way that I feel it now was when I was in grade school. And that was when we were in the Cold War. You remember anybody else had to do the drills where you hid under your desk? Like that was going to save us, right, from a nuclear disaster, right? But they had us hide under our desk and, you know, cover our heads. And we got out of the Cold War by creating some strategies. And we're still in it a little bit, right? But we created some strategies and some ways to, you know, downsize our nuclear arsenals, et cetera, and some agreements with other people. And but it was pretty much, it's not like you had to actively do a lot. Well, this time, the war that we're facing now is called climate change. And we're losing. So if we don't actually create strategies, winning strategies, to actually do something, then we are going to lose. Now, why can't the West just solve this problem? It's not just greed. It's a whole worldview that's behind the greed. And that worldview has been developed over 3,000 years. I mean, if we just want to go back to the roots, you know, let's think about, you know, what are the classics, right? If you go to Oxford and you study the classics, or if you go to Harvard and you study the classics, or you go almost anywhere, you can go to where I used to work at George Fox, study the classics, you're reading Plato and you're reading Homer and you're reading, you know, all the sort of Greek and Roman philosophers. So what did Plato actually teach? He taught that reality is this ethereal realm and that the physical is a little bit lower than that. So basically that the ideal of a thing is the real thing, not the thing itself. And what we call that is Platonic dualism. And the West actually has a whole history of taking that and running with it. So Plato taught it to Aristotle, who sort of, I guess, put his own twist on it. And Aristotle, his, you know, Plato's student, then taught it to his famous student. Anybody know who that was? What's that? No, Socrates was Plato's teacher. But we don't really know how much Plato was, or Socrates was a dualist, because everything that was written about him was he wrote was destroyed. Everything Plato said about him is in, you know, we don't know if it was Plato's words or his words. But anyway, so we start with Plato. So we have Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. And Aristotle taught a young student named Alexander. And his last name was the Great. And Alexander spread this idea of Greek and Platonic dualism of this, what we call Hellenism, spread around the known world at that time. And he conquered people and he conquered nations in order to make that happen. So Alexander's busy, so spreading this all over into, like, even Egypt becomes a Greek center of learning. Alexandria becomes like the world's greatest library of all these philosophers and everything. And so, you know, it goes around and it spreads, and then Rome, of course, becomes the inheritor of this philosophy, and then Rome passes it on to Great Britain. And Great Britain, just when it was starting to die out, they have something called the Renaissance, right, between the 14th and 17th centuries. What's Renaissance mean? Rebirth, right, renewal, revival of Hellenism, right? So now it's, again, read all the Greek philosophers and the Roman philosophers. Read our architecture has to be after them, our literature, our art, et cetera, et cetera. And so the whole Renaissance is this Platonic dualism embedded in everything, in each way it goes. And remember, that means that the ethereal is more important than the material, right? That's a split in reality, which is unreality, by the way. And so it affects England, and then and it affects most of Western Europe and even parts of Eastern Europe. And out of that, there are two movements that are born. And one is the Enlightenment, right? And the Enlightenment doubles down on it, you know, with Descartes and, you know, Bacon and Adam Smith, and just all of these people who are, quote unquote, founding fathers, read deeply. And to the point where, like, Descartes, René Descartes says, I am a mind, but I just have a body. So in other words, this old body in this material world is just not really real, but it's what's thought in the mind that is. And then the other movement, I call these the evil twins out of the that the Renaissance gave birth to, is the Reformation. And what happens in the Reformation? The Reformation doubles down as well. And what it says is that the products of the mind are most important. And sometimes they call it the spirit. But the products, like the Bible, for example, you know, and doctrine. Doctrine is so important during this movement that they will kill each other over it. Right? The Protestants will kill the Catholics. The Catholics will kill the Protestants. The Protestants will kill each other. They'll kill the Mennonites, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you have all of these religious wars. By the way, we had war in America before, quote unquote, discovery, but there was never a religious war in America. It's interesting, isn't it? Before 1492. What happens? We become infected with it. It's embedded in all our systems. It's how we learn. We learn by knowledge, and then you're supposed to go out and do the thing you learned. You know, we don't learn mostly by apprenticeship. Apprenticeship's great. We don't learn by experience as much as we learn, you know, I go to school for 12 years, then I graduate and I go to college, then I go get a master's degree if I really want to be like an expert, and if I want to be an expert of the experts, then I go get a PhD in that area. And maybe I've done all of this, but I've never actually practiced the thing that I'm studying. That's American education. That's dualistic. Religion's the same. It's about how we understand ourselves and how we confess and our doctrines rather than what we actually do. Well, when I talk to elders in our indigenous communities and I say, what are your beliefs? Because the Western worldview, and especially religion, is mostly about beliefs, right? I say, what are your beliefs? And I remember one guy said to me one time, well, you know, I believe in treating my wife well and providing for my family. I believe in like helping people out when they need help. And he went on, and all of those things that he does, right? That's what he believes. The things that you do. So I've got two more things to say. One's an example and another's a story. Because I think you're getting the point. Are you? Yeah. So, the Willendas. Anybody remember the tightrope walkers? So Carl Willenda walked across Niagara Falls. Right? He put and first he asked the people. He had a rope stretch across Niagara Falls. And I've been to Niagara Falls. It's a very scary thing. Almost as scary as the Niagara River, how fast it goes, because if you fall in, that's it. He stretches a rope across and he says, how many believe that I can walk across Niagara Falls and back? And so, you know, they all raise their hand. So he does it and he comes back and he says, how many of you believe I can walk across Niagara Falls with a person on my shoulders and back? And they all raise their hand. And he said, who wants to get on my shoulders? And all the hands went down, right? And he said, then you don't believe. That's a non-dualistic way of looking at life, right? Last story I want to share is a Cherokee story. It comes from my people. And it said that there's a time when our Cherokee people were beginning to not be grateful for the animals that they killed, and they would like just leave the, you know, everything but the best parts and cut it up and be wasteful and not give thanks. And so the animals got together and they said, you know, we got to put a stop to this. And so the bears decided to lead them. And so the bears start going like, well, how are they killing us? And so the rest of the animals would say, you know, they're killing us with bows and arrows. All right, well, that's what we need to do. Then we need to get bows and arrows and kill them. And so they, you know, they went and they found black locusts and they made their bows and they made their arrows. But the problem was with the bears is they had these long claws and they'd pull back and they couldn't aim right. Arrows were going everywhere, you know. So finally the rest of the animals got tired of the bears leading. And they decided to elect somebody else. And so they elected the grubworm. And so the grubworm decides that she's going to lead them. And so she listens to what everybody has to say and then finally comes up with the idea that kind of listened to what everyone had to say and it gels. And she says, what I think I'm hearing is let's put diseases on them. And so they are like, yeah, that's it. So they start thinking of diseases to put on the people. And they think of like smallpox and chicken pox and swine flu and, you know, all these kinds of diseases. And the people started to die. And, you know, first the story goes, because we are a matrilineal society, first the old people and the young people begin to die. And then the men begin to die. And then finally the strong women begin to die. And by the way, in our Cherokee origin story, woman is the first human. So, yeah, how about a hand there for the Cherokees? Huh? So, and so they said, no, we're not going to be a tribe anymore. We've got to go and convince the animals to stop. And so they went to the animal council. And they said, you know, please, we beg you, stop. But the animals said, no, we're not going to stop. So they continued to die, and then finally the plant people were looking on. And the plants held a council, and they said, you know, we feel sorry for the human beings, so let's help them out. And so they began to send plant medicines in people's dreams so that they knew how to heal themselves. And so in each dream, they were told, you know, you go and you pick this and you use this part. And so the people started to get well again. And finally, after that, the human council and the animal council and the plant council all came together as one. And they decided from now on that the plants would always give their medicines and the bears and the other animals would always give themselves. But there were certain conditions, and these are still the conditions today for a Cherokee hunter. You have to, first of all, pray and sing a song before you go out and hunt. Secondly, that animal has to give itself to you. And any time you take an animal or you take a plant, you have to put down tobacco and say a prayer. And you thank Great Spirit, you thank the earth herself, and you thank that animal who gave its life for you. And all of that was required to remind us to be thankful and that it costs something to eat, basically. And so that's the way the story goes. And even today we believe that for every disease that's caused by an animal, that's an animal disease, that there's a plant that can heal it. And there, we still have some of those today, some of those cures. So find out sort of like, well, what do we learn from that story? The biggest lesson we learn from that story is that unless we are cooperating with the whole community of creation together, what are the animals saying? What are the plants saying? What are the trees saying? What are the people saying? We all have to work together in the same level. We don't see ourselves as above nature. We don't see ourselves as below nature. We see ourselves with nature in the cycle, in the circle, sacred circle. And we're not more important than anything else. But we do have a role to play. And our role is primarily as co-sustainers or keepers of the land and all the resources in the land. Thank you.
We'll just do one quick verse of Ancient Mother. Yeah. Thank you, Randy. It's number 1069 in the Teal Hymnal. Ancient Mother, I hear you calling. Ancient Mother, I hear your call. Ancient Mother, I hear you clapture, Ancient Mother, I hear your tears. Thank you. And thank you, Randy, for sharing such vitally important message today of the circle of all of life and how we can be stewards together with the land. And we extinguish this chalice today, this flame that burns as inspiration to help move us forward. It does not extinguish the vision or compassion of our faith. May they stay with us until we meet together again.
Carry the flame of peace and love until we meet again.